This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Bees. This is lecture 8. It's actually the last lecture, but there's also an extract after this of various lectures. Lecture 8, given in Dornach, December 22nd, 1923. Good morning, gentlemen. We need to continue speaking about Mr. Dollinger's question. He had posed this question for you, and I'm sure all of you will find this to be of interest. Of what the connection is, on a spiritual level, between the entire horde of insects that goes to the plants and that which is in the plants. You see, gentlemen, I said earlier that everywhere around us are not only elements such as oxygen and nitrogen, but there is present throughout nature also intelligence and understanding. Nobody is astonished if you say, "We inhale the air," because the air is all around us, and because the scientific explanation that is now printed in every schoolbook tells us that air is everywhere, and that we breathe in this air. But I have known, for example, people out in the country who thought this was a figment of the imagination. They simply didn't know that air is everywhere, the same way that people today don't know that the power of mind is present around us in nature. They are the ones who consider it a bit of fantasy if you say that in the same way we inhale air with the help of our lungs, we also inhale, in quotes, this power of mind, for example, with our noses or ears. And I've given you numerous examples by which you can see that the power of mind is present everywhere. Last time we spoke about a particularly interesting chapter of natural science, about bees, wasps, and ants. Perhaps there is no better place in nature to obtain such a thorough insight into the inner workings of nature than in the activities of insects. Insects just happen to be truly remarkable creatures, and they will in the future still reveal quite a few secrets to us. It is worth noting that we are discussing insects at the same time that we are celebrating the 100th anniversary of the famous scientist specializing in insect research, Jean-Henri Faber, who was born a century ago on December 22nd, and lived at just the time when materialism began pervading science. Footnote: Jean-Henri Faber, 1823-1915, French scholar and researcher specializing in insects. His main work was Souvenir Entomologique, and then there's some other parts of the title I can't read in French, 10 volumes, 1879-1907. End of footnote. For this reason, he interpreted everything materialistically, but he did bring to light a great many facts about the life of insects. For this reason, it is natural that we think of him as we discuss insects today. First, I would like to give you an example of a type of insect that you will find interesting because of its connection with bees. A bee achieves a high degree of perfection in the work that it accomplishes. The most remarkable thing about a bee is not that it produces honey, but that it can produce completely out of itself, out of its own body, these carefully constructed honeycomb cells. It has to carry into the beehive whatever it uses as building materials. It works in such a way that it doesn't use this material in the original form, but rather brings it into the beehive already completely transformed. The bee does this all by itself, and what it creates comes directly out of itself. There is, however, another genus of bee which doesn't accomplish its tasks in the same way as the common honeybee does. The unique method employed by this bee demonstrates the tremendous power of mind or intelligence that exists in all of nature. Let's observe for a moment the work methods of this type of bee, normally called the wood bee, Zyolocopa violacea, that's more or less the Latin, I think. Normally called the wood bee, and not as highly regarded as the common honeybee, because it can be a nuisance for human beings. This is an extremely industrious bee, a bee that must really overcome difficult circumstances in order to ensure its survival, not the survival of the individual bee, but of the entire genus. This animal looks for wood that no longer is part of a tree but has been cut and processed for use elsewhere. You can find this wood bee with its nests, which I'll describe for you shortly, anywhere you have a wooden plug or peg that has been hammered into the ground or somewhere else. Such pieces of dead wood as serve to hold down tents or to create wooden columns, and also wooden garden benches or garden doors, can serve as likely nesting sites. In there you'll find the wood bee. Imagine that this is such a post. He draws on the blackboard, table 12, page 167 left. This also is wood that no longer serves as part of a tree. Now, along comes the wood bee and drills an entry hole into the post at an angle. When the bee makes it all the way into the center, has removed all the excess wood pieces, and has enlarged the entrance to become a bit more like a channel, it begins to drill in a completely different direction. It drills in such a way that a small ring-shaped chamber is formed. Then the insect flies away, brings back all sorts of materials from nearby, and lines the chamber with these wadding materials. When it is finished, it lays an egg in there, from which a larva will emerge. This egg lies there in the chamber. After having laid the egg, the little bee makes a lid, in the center of which there is a hole. It continues drilling above this lid and fashions a second chamber for another larva to use as its living space. After having lined the chamber with wadding, laid a second egg, and provided a lid with a hole in it, the bee continues in the next chamber and so on until it has made 10 or 12 such chambers, one on top of the other. In each there is an egg. The larva can develop inside the wood. Into each chamber the bee has placed food for each larva. The larva eats the food that has been prepared for it and grows until it is mature enough to crawl out. But now the time comes when the insect changes into a chrysalis, then becomes a bee with wings, and wants to fly from the nest. When this mature insect wants to leave the nest, it must depart via the original entrance corridor. Here we see evidence of the cleverness of the would-bee, in that the mature insect can leave the nest using the passageway that had been drilled out first. That's fine so far. But when the second insect, which is younger than the first, and then the third, the egg of which was laid even more recently, and so on, want to leave, these later insects, for whom living quarters were constructed later by the mother-bee, will not be able to find an exiting passageway, because only one such entrance or exit was drilled out. An awkward situation now arises, because those bees confined to the upper chambers would be doomed to die eventually, since there is no easy way out for them. The mother averts this catastrophe by creating the little holes in the lids, which the younger insects can find and through which they can let themselves drop before crawling out of the main entrance. The bee from the third egg, after it has developed sufficiently, drops through the two holes made for the lower chambers, where the previous residents, who are older and have already matured and then escaped, no longer live. In this way the younger insects do not disturb those in the chambers below, which are now empty since the insects once there have matured and left. There is never any contact between them because the older ones are not there. You see, the entire nest has been planned with such great wisdom and foresight that you can't help but be astonished. When people today mechanically try to reproduce things, they are usually created in imitation, but the result is often not as skillfully made as nature would do it. Things as they exist in nature are created with extraordinary skill. And you would have to admit that there is definitely evidence of intelligence and understanding. You could find hundreds or even thousands of examples to illustrate this point by examining how insects build and how they act when they are at work. Just consider how much knowledge and understanding is evidenced by the agricultural ants in the agricultural operation that I told you about recently. We also observed another matter as we were looking at these bees, wasps, and ants. I told you that these creatures have a substance in them that is poisonous, and that this poisonous substance is at the same time an excellent medicine if the proper dose is determined and prescribed. Bee poison is an exceptional medicine with curative powers, as is wasp poison. And formic acid, which ants secrete, is an even better medicine. And I've indicated something else to you. We can get this formic acid by disturbing an anthill, collecting the ants, and then squeezing them. Mainly we obtain formic acid from ants, but if you knew, relatively speaking, how much formic acid is in this hall, you would be very astonished. You would say, "We certainly can't look for an anthill here in the corner of this hall." Gentlemen, just as you sit there, you are truly an anthill yourselves. For everywhere in your arms and legs, muscles and other tissues, heart, lung, liver, spleen, everywhere, you'll find formic acid. To be sure, it's not as concentrated or as strong as you'll find in an anthill, but even so, you are completely saturated with formic acid. Yes, this is something very strange. Why do we have this formic acid in our bodies? You can determine whether a person has too little of it. If someone appears to you with an illness, actually most humans are just a bit sick, this person might have any of 100 different illnesses that all look alike externally. You need to recognize that this sick person is actually lacking. The fact that a person is pale or unable to eat, these are only superficial signs. You need to determine what it is that is really lacking. With some people, it is simply that they don't have enough of the anthill in themselves, that they don't generate enough formic acid. The same way in which the anthill produces formic acid, the body must make formic acid all over, but particularly in the spleen. If a person produces an insufficient amount of formic acid, such an individual needs to be given a medicinal preparation, a remedy, by means of which you help externally create enough formic acid within the body. But it is important to notice the changes that take place in a person who just happens to have too little formic acid. These observations can only be made when those who wish to observe these matters truly have a thorough understanding of human nature. You need to create a clear picture in your mind of what is going on in a person's soul, a person who at first has had sufficient formic acid within, and then later has too little of this substance. This is truly remarkable. Such a person will tell you, if you ask in the correct way, the right things about the illness. Assume, for instance, you have before you an individual who tells you, after being inspired to think along certain lines, "Several years ago I could remember just about everything. I could think back and reflect on past occurrences very well. Now I have trouble with that. I don't seem to be able to do it anymore. Every time I try to think back, I just can't remember." Gentlemen, this is often a much more important indication than all the results of external medical tests can give you, tests that you naturally should also undertake. Today you can test urine for the albumin content, for pus, for sugar, and for other constituents, and you'll get rather interesting results. But under certain circumstances, it can't be much more important than a person describes a symptom such as suffering from memory loss. For when an individual tells you something like that, you will naturally have to obtain more information, and then you might come to the following conclusion. In the most recent period of this person's life, the level of formic acid in the body has decreased to the point of becoming insufficient for supporting certain important functions. Now, someone who still thinks on an external level could say, "This person doesn't have enough formic acid within. Either I'll squeeze some ants to get formic acid, or I'll create it synthetically in a laboratory. Then I'll administer formic acid in an appropriate dose." You can do this for a period of time, but the patient will come to you later and say, "But this stuff didn't help me one bit." What is the situation here? It really doesn't help the patient at all. The diagnosis was completely correct. The person didn't have enough formic acid in the system. You administered formic acid, and it didn't do any good at all. So what do we have going on here? You see, if you research this matter, you'll discover the real explanation. The formic acid doesn't help a particular individual, but with others it is always successful. After a while, you begin to notice the difference. In the case of those patients whom the formic acid helped, you will find that they show evidence of a mucus obstruction in the lungs. The other patients who derive no benefit from the formic acid as a medication are those in whom you will discover mucus obstructions in the liver, kidneys, or spleen. This turns out to be a rather peculiar situation. There is a great difference between an insufficient amount of formic acid in the lungs and the same situation in the liver. The difference exists by virtue of the fact that the lung can completely use the formic acid that comes from an ant colony, but the liver can't do anything at all with it. And now, here is something else, gentlemen. If you notice that a person has a problem with the liver, or specifically the intestines, and formic acid doesn't help at all, then you'll have to dispense oxalic acid. That means that you'll have to press the juice out of the common wood sorrel, or from clover that grows in the fields, derive the acid from it, and give it as medicine. So you see, if a person has a problem with the lungs, you need to give formic acid. If a person has a problem with the liver or intestines, you have to give oxalic acid. The strange thing, however, is that the person to whom you give oxalic acid will, after a certain amount of time, begin to produce formic acid within. What's really important is that you don't simply administer from outside the patient things that you want the patient to take as medicine, but rather you really must know what the human organism will do with this remedy on its own. If you give formic acid, then the organism will say, "That's not for me. I want to do the work by myself." In this case, you administered the formic acid already prepared for the body to use directly. "There's no work involved in it for me. I'll not get it up into the lungs." Naturally, you have to give this medicine in such a manner that it will go into the stomach. In the end, it will go into the intestines. At this point, the human organism tells the body that is ready to do its work, "What are you giving me here? You mean to tell me that I'm not supposed to create formic acid by myself first, but that you want me to take this formic acid that you put into the stomach and convey it to the lungs where it is needed? No, I refuse to do it." The human organism really wants to have oxalic acid so that it can transform it into formic acid on its own. Yes, gentlemen, life involves work, not substances. And the most important thing to know is that life doesn't consist at all in simply eating cabbage, turnips, or beets, but rather in what the body must do when the cabbage, turnip, or beet substances are taken into the digestive system. In any case, the body must not produce cabbage all over again from the cabbage that has just arrived in the digestive system. This is remarkably the very thing that is at the basis of our present-day civilization. But you'll see from this example what an unusual relationship exists within nature. Out there are the plants. The clover plant has been defined in the German language in a very special way. Kliesäure literally means acid from clover. But actually, clover acid, or oxalic acid, is found in all plants. It is simply that its greatest concentration is in the clover plant. That's why we talk about clover acid in German. Just as you will find formic acid, in German this is called ant acid, or acid from ants, since ants supply it in concentrated form, everywhere in nature and everywhere in the human body. Likewise, you will find everywhere in nature and in the human body Kliesäure, or oxalic acid. Now, here is another very interesting fact. Take the following experiment. You have a retort, the kind you find in a chemical laboratory. You place a flame under it and introduce some oxalic acid into this retort. This is a salty, crumbly ash. Then add the same quantity of glycerin. You mix these constituents together and heat them. The steamy vapors will move over here, he draws on the blackboard, table 12, and you will be able to collect at the open end whatever comes out. But at the same time that this is happening, you notice that air is escaping all over. When you examine and analyze this escaping air, you find out that it is carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is escaping. And here, where you are collecting what is coming over, you have formic acid. Now, there's formic acid. But in the retort, you have oxalic acid and glycerin. The glycerin remains, and the other part moves over. The liquid formic acid drops down over here, and carbon dioxide escapes at this point. Now take a very good look at this whole procedure. Assume for a moment that instead of a retort, you had the human liver before you, or, let's say, any human or animal tissue. He draws on the blackboard, table 12, upper middle. Any organ located in the animal abdomen, liver, spleen, or another organ of that type. Through the stomach, I introduce oxalic acid. The body has by itself glycerin. So then, I have in my intestines both oxalic acid and glycerin. And what happens? Now examine the human mouth. That is where the carbon dioxide escapes, and the formic acid drops down from the lungs in every direction toward the other organs in the human body. So this whole process that I have sketched for you is really taking place in our own bodies. We are constantly producing formic acid from oxalic acid in our bodies. Now think of all the plants that are found all over the earth. In all of them, you'll find oxalic acid. And think of the insects. In the case of insects, the facts emerge in a very remarkable way. Think first of all of the ants. They go to these plants or to the rotting material that comes from plants. Everywhere, in all these things, there is oxalic acid. And these animals, just as humans do themselves, make formic acid from them. This formic acid is present everywhere. Insects make it possible for formic acid to be present everywhere. Yes, a Philistine will look into the air and say that in the air there is nitrogen and oxygen. But, gentlemen, there is always formic acid present in a very small amount, because the insects fly through the air. What this means is that we have on one side the human being. The human being is a microcosm, a little world or universe. A person creates formic acid within and saturates the breath continually with formic acid. And in the macrocosm, in the great world or universe, the process that takes place within the human being is replaced by the whole army of insects. The great breath of air that surrounds the entire earth is saturated with the formic acid that is created from the oxalic acid present in plants. It really happens this way. Table 13, page 167. If you observe correctly and examine the lower part of the body of a human being with the stomach, liver, kidneys, spleen, and intestines, you will find that it is true that oxalic acid is continually being transformed into formic acid in these organs. This formic acid enters along with the air a person inhales, and in this way it is distributed to all the parts of the body. This is what goes on in human beings. On this earth, you have plants everywhere. Then you have, in various forms, the insects that fly over it. Down there you have oxalic acid. The insects fly to the plants and make contact with them. Through this contact, formic acid is created and spreads throughout the air, so that we also breathe in formic acid that is present in the air around us. That which the wasps have is a poison very similar to formic acid, only partially transformed. That which bees carry around in their stingers, actually the entire body of the bee possesses it, is also transformed formic acid, but transformed to a higher degree. When you examine this, you come to say to yourself, we look at these insects, ants, wasps, bees, and find that they are doing a very smart thing. Why are they doing something that appears to show so much intelligence? If the ant didn't have any formic acid, it would accomplish all those marvelous things which I have described for you in a rather stupid manner. Only because ants are created in such a way that they can produce formic acid does everything that they construct seem so full of understanding and reason. The same is true for wasps and bees. Doesn't this give us occasion to say to ourselves, if we also produce this formic acid within ourselves, that in nature understanding and knowledge are found everywhere? This is all due to formic acid. We also have understanding and knowledge within us because we have formic acid. Formic acid would not exist if it weren't for oxalic acid being present beforehand. And so the little insects flutter about the plants and are the reason why the oxalic acid in plants is changed into formic acid, or, if you will, undergoes a metamorphosis. These are the things you begin to understand only if you now ask yourself what the situation is with oxalic acid. You see, oxalic acid is present everywhere where there is life. Wherever something is alive, there is oxalic acid. But there is also an etheric body. One function that the etheric body carries out is that it immediately renews oxalic acid. However, oxalic acid will never become formic acid of a type that a human or animal organism can use unless the astral body transforms the oxalic acid into formic acid. For it is a fact that the formic acid that is derived from the process in the retort is a formic acid that will be of no benefit to the human or animal body. You'll be deceived if you believe that it can really help at all, because in reality, it is dead. The formic acid created in humans and by insects is alive. And it appears wherever sensations and feelings arise and the soul element is present. A human being must develop formic acid within if such a person wants to generate the soul element from the basic level of life processes that exist in the lower body, where oxalic acid plays a very important role. Then the soul element lives in the formic acid of the breath and rises to the head, where it can continue to function and become effective. The soul element needs this process that converts oxalic acid into formic acid within a human being. What really happens when the oxalic acid is converted into formic acid? You see, the first thing that I told you about can give you the answer. This would-be I spoke about is very interesting in this regard, just because it works its way into wood that no longer has life in it. If this would-be could not properly use the wood, it would probably seek its nest elsewhere. It doesn't bore its nest into living trees, but rather into already rotting wood. Wherever posts begin to rot is a place where it lays its eggs after it has constructed its nest. If you study the connection between rotting material and the would-bees, you'll eventually find out that the same process that occurs in rotting wood also takes place continually in the human body. It begins to rot, and if it rots too much, it dies. The process that takes place in nature is the same one a human being must carry out. A person needs to construct cells. This is something an individual can do only by transforming plant material that is saturated with oxalic acid into formic acid, into a substance that is saturated with formic acid. Now you can ask what significance this whole process has for nature. Well, gentlemen, let's imagine a wooden post that is decaying. People would prefer that a would-bee never come near their posts, since these bees usually spread out quite a bit within the post, and the next year this post would probably fall over because the bees have hollowed it out. People may not really like this very much, but nature loves this process all the more for the benefits it derives from it. For if all the wood that comes from plants were to continue its existence without these bees' nests, the wood would eventually, you can watch this process as things rot, crumble, fall to dust, and become entirely useless material. However, the wood in which a would-bee has worked does not simply get scattered about, but on the contrary, it takes on life again. And from all this wood that has been slightly enlivened again by these would-bees, and for that matter, likewise by other insects, much of that material will arise that will keep the earth from decaying completely, from becoming a cloud of dust in space. This material will make it possible for the earth to continue its life, because it is constantly being restored to life by these insects. As human beings, we inhale formic acid. But in nature, the formic acid that is prepared by insects from the oxalic acid of plants functions in such a way that it becomes the only way to make possible the continued existence of the earth at all. Now, examine the connection between these things. Here we have the human being, and here the earth. Table 13. Let's look at the human being first. Let's assume it's a young child. As long as this child is still young, it can transform very easily the oxalic acid located in the lower body into formic acid. The organs get enough formic acid. The human soul develops within the child. So here we have formic acid as the foundation for soul and spirit. And when a human becomes old and can't develop enough formic acid anymore, the soul and spirit leave. It's the formic acid that attracts and mobilizes soul and spirit. Otherwise, the spirit will go away. This is very interesting. For example, you observe properly a person with very many internal purulent infections, you'll find it is true that formic acid will help such a person overcome these infections. Then the proper relationship between the astral body and the physical body will reestablish itself, a relationship that was disturbed and hindered by the infections. We can say that formic acid is always used in the proper way as the foundation for soul and spirit. If the body just happens to have too little formic acid, it will decay and will no longer be able to support the soul. The body ages, and the soul must leave. Now, we have the human being on one side, here. On the other side is nature. In nature as well, formic acid is derived continuously from oxalic acid, so that the earth constantly has the possibility of being surrounded not only by oxygen and nitrogen, but also by formic acid. Table 13. This formic acid makes it possible for the earth not to die off completely each year, but instead to be able to resuscitate itself year after year. What is located beneath the earth as seed has a longing for formic acid, and this is what the process of rejuvenation consists of. Every winter the spirit of the earth is itself striving to leave or simply go away, and in spring it restores itself to life again. The spirit of the earth causes the earth to become rigid and stiff in winter. In spring, it enlivens the earth once more. This happens because that which waits under the earth as seed comes into contact with the formic acid that had been created the previous year by the interaction of the insect world with the plant world. The seeds develop, grow, and make contact not only with oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide, but also with formic acid. This formic acid stimulates them to develop oxalic acid once again by themselves, which in turn makes it possible for formic acid to be present the next year. But just as formic acid in a human being can provide the basis for the presence of soul and spirit, so likewise the formic acid that is spread out over the cosmos provides the foundation for the presence of the earth's spiritual and soul element. Now we can say that in the case of the earth, formic acid is also the basis for the earth's soul and the earth's spirit. Table 13. It is actually more difficult to transmit a telegram in a region where there are not ant colonies than it is in a region where they exist, because the electricity and the magnetism needed for telegraphy depend upon formic acid. When the telegraph wires go through a city where there are no ants, the power to accomplish transmission must come from the countryside, where the wires pass through the fields, so that the magnetic and electric currents will make its way through the cities at all. But naturally, formic acid spreads itself out and also fills the air that exists in the cities. Well, gentlemen, now you see that we can say that whatever is contained within a human being, with regard to the production of formic acid as well, also exists in nature. A human being is a microcosm, a small world. It is uniquely the case with a human being that throughout life until death a person possesses the capacity to make formic acid from oxalic acid. But then a human being loses this capability and the physical body dies. Then the human soul has to wait before once again receiving a body, which in a child properly transforms oxalic acid into formic acid. With nature this process continues on and on, winter, summer, winter, summer. The oxalic acid is always transformed into formic acid. If you carefully observe a dying individual, you'll get the feeling that there is an effort on the part of this person, even in the process of dying, to find out whether the body is still capable of creating formic acid. Then, at the point when the body is no longer capable of the task, death takes over. A human being goes into the spirit world and can't endure any longer being in the body. We can say that a human being dies at a certain point in time, and after a long period of time comes back in another body. Meanwhile, this person is in the spirit world. When a young queen emerges in a beehive, as I've told you, there is something that disturbs the bees. Up until this event, the bees have been living in what might be called a twilight. Then they see the young queen giving off a light. What is connected with the shining of this young queen? What is connected with it is that the young queen is taking away the power of the bee poison that the old queen possesses. And this, gentlemen, is the great fear of a swarm that leaves its hive. It is afraid that it no longer possesses bee poison, a state that means that it can't defend itself anymore or save itself. So it moves away from this disturbing source, the young queen. In the same way that the human soul leaves the body when it can't get enough formic acid, the older bees also leave when there is an insufficient amount of altered formic acid, bee poison, present. And if you now look at a swarm of bees, it is to be sure visible, but it really looks like the soul of a human being, a soul that is forced to leave its body. This is truly a grand sight, to see a horde of bees swarming away. In the same way in which the human soul leaves the body, so also does the old queen, after a young queen reaches adulthood, leave the hive with her company. You can really see, by looking at the escaping swarm of bees, an image of the human soul flying away from the body. Oh, gentlemen, this is a grand sight to behold. There's only a slight difference, in that the human soul has never reached the point of developing its power sufficiently to create these little creatures. Within us there is continually the tendency to want to do this. We want to become many tiny creatures. We actually have within ourselves a tendency to continually want to change the form of things inside our bodies so that they become like crawling bacilli or bacteria or like little bees. But we suppress this process before it happens. In so doing, we become complete human beings and not a collection of tiny entities. But the beehive is not a complete human being. Bees can't find their way into the spirit world. We have to take them to an empty beehive to bring about a rebirth or reincarnation of these bees. This is very directly a picture of reincarnating human beings. That person who can observe such a phenomenon develops a tremendous respect for these old swarming bees with their queen, a swarm that acts the way it does because it is trying to find its way into the spiritual world. But this swarm has become so caught up in the material world, so physical, that it can no longer fulfill this desire. So the bees cuddle up together and become a single body. They want very much to be together. They want to leave this world. And you also know that while they are flying about, they might attach themselves to a tree trunk or something similar, and then they press themselves together in order to disappear, because they want to gain entrance into the spirit world. And then they once again become a proper colony when we help them by bringing them back to their new beehive. So from this description, you could probably say that insects teach us nothing short of what might be considered the highest understanding we can derive from nature. This is why looking at plants always enlightened the people of antiquity, who still had an instinctive sense for these things that I've been explaining to you, matters that present-day science has lost sight of completely. Back then, people looked upon plants in a very special way. In our day, people are sometimes reminded of some of these things. For instance, when they bring home a fir tree and make a Christmas tree out of it. Then people are reminded of the fact that the way things are in nature can also become something important in the lives of human beings, can be something that can have an effect on our social lives. It's supposed to be a symbol of love, this fir tree transformed into a Christmas tree. People generally believe that the idea of a Christmas tree is very old, but the fir tree was first used as a Christmas tree probably only 150 to 200 years ago. Before that time, this custom didn't exist. But people did use a type of bush at Christmas. For example, during the Christmas plays that were performed in villages as early as the 15th and 16th centuries, there was someone who ran about advertising the play and also carried in his hand what might be considered a Christmas tree. But this was the so-called Kranewittbaum, a term known only in Middle Germany. In reality, this tree is the juniper, which has wonderful berries. Footnote, this refers to the traditional Christmas plays of Oberufer. End of footnote. Back then, people took a juniper to serve as a Christmas tree. Why? Because the juniper berries that birds so much like to eat showed them the slight effect of poison that arises and must be penetrated by the earth element so that the spiritual element might arise within it. The same way that the ant is drawn to wooden material or the wood bee goes to posts, another much weaker acid is produced all over every morning by the bird picking at the berries on the juniper. The people of antiquity knew this instinctively and said to themselves that during winter, when the juniper stands there and the birds come to pick its berries, the earth is once again rejuvenated, re-enlivened by means of the juniper. From this natural phenomenon, people formed a picture in their minds, one with a moral sense. Christ is re-enlivening the earth. So now we can already say, looking at things in a properly natural way, we can see in all the processes of nature symbols and representations of those things that occur in human life. People long ago looked at the birds sitting in a juniper with the same love as people today have when they see little Christmas cookies or the presents under the Christmas tree. The juniper was for these people a kind of Christmas tree that they carried into their homes. So it is that a juniper was made into something like a Christmas tree. And we need to come to a conclusion. I didn't want to allow today's session to pass by. I know this is a very stressful time for all of you, without having spoken about a very important subject. And we made it all the way to some thoughts about a bush that might really be looked upon as a Christmas tree, the juniper, which offers to birds the same things that plants offer to bees, and that wood offers to ants and wood bees, and generally to all insects. Finally, I would like to take this opportunity to wish you all a very happy, joyful, inwardly uplifting Christmas. We'll let you know when the next lecture will be. It'll be sometime in the near future. End of lecture, and there's a note in reference to the would-be, page 142. Quote, with a loud buzzing sound, the female bee, having made it through the winter, flies out to search for a suitable home for its progeny among the boards of a stockade fence, lathe work, or wooden posts. Any old wood, a rotting post, a brittle tree trunk with its bark falling off will do for the difficult task this bee needs to complete. With great diligence, this bee gnaws a hole into the wood about as large as the circumference of its body. It then penetrates several annual rings of the wood before it begins boring downward. The excess wood is removed as it bores deeper and deeper, creating a tube or channel that can attain the length of 1 foot before it begins bending in a somewhat outward direction again. This mother allows herself only occasional breaks, during which time she flies to nearby flowers to obtain honey nectar to restore her energies. She finishes her tube-like chamber before the end of May. In the lowest part, she places a mixture of honey nectar and pollen upon which she lays a single egg. Then, measuring upward to a height that approximates the circumference of the tube, she creates a lid made of concentric rings of kneaded sawdust. Thus the first cell has been closed off, making it possible to place another cell above it. This cell has the same dimensions as the first, and another egg is placed into it. Before it, too, is sealed off with a lid. This process is repeated over and over without interruption until an entire column of cells is formed. After a few days, the young maggot emerges from the egg. It lies in a curved position and takes up almost all the space in the cell by the time that it matures to the next stage about 3 weeks later. Then it spins a cocoon and changes into a chrysalis. Since the lowermost egg was the earliest laid, it will be the first to reach maturity. The second would be next, and the uppermost would be last. Will the first egg wait to mature until all its siblings have achieved their maturity before it makes its way out of this prison? There is no way that it will wait that long. It is situated standing on its head and will have to move only slightly forward, where it will discover that the cell wall will yield and break open. Then it will continue until it reaches the end of the curve, which is filled with loose wood materials somewhat similar to sawdust. Then it gnaws away the thin layer, separating it from the warm summer air. A second one that crawls out follows the first until all the siblings have emerged by the end of July or the beginning of August. The nest is now empty. This is from Jean-Henri Faber's book. That's the end of that lecture and excerpt.